G'day mate, how you going? This is Adam O'Brien and welcome to Fandom Podcast Network, here where we enjoy all forms of fandom. Well, coming to you live from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia, I bring you Lethal Mullet Podcast, an Australian look at B-grade action films from the 1980s. That's right, going back to that beloved time when we had Chuck Norris on almost every Friday night here in Australia, kicking, punching, and shooting his way to the top, alongside Jean-Claude Van Damme, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the likes of many of the others that came after him, Sylvester Stallone. We even look at some of the heroes you may not know, all here on one Fortnite with Podcasts here on the Fandom Podcast Network. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can check it out also on Podbean if you've got the Podbean app. Make sure you check it out. Now, let's get into the episode here on Fandom Podcast Network. And welcome to the one, the only Fandom Podcast Network, bringing you Lethal Mullet Podcast, a celebration of 1980s action cinema. Big grade is best, of course, in this challenge that we have to look at all the greatest from 1980 to 1989 when it comes to B-grade action films. Welcome to episode 5. I'm your host, Adam O'Brien, coming to you live from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia. But joining me tonight, all the way from the United States, is the co-founders of this amazing channel, the Fandom Podcast Network itself. Co-founders Kyle Wagner and Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel. Guys, how are you?
I'm good. Yeah, you know, just checking around, making sure I have my Uzi, my mullet, my headband, pumping up the veins a little bit. You know, I'm ready for some 80s action. What about you, Kevin?
Oh, I'm ready for this. I've been really excited to talk about Invasion USA. This movie holds a special place in my heart, so I'm excited.
That's right. Now, this is a look at one of the greatest films Chuck did, and it's definitely probably the one that Canon Films put as much money as they could behind it. This is the one where they said, let's bank on Chuck Norris, and you can see that from here on, his career is going from high to high. So we'll be looking at that tonight, but before we get into that, Kevin, how can we get in contact with everyone?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Spartan_Phoenix.
You can find me on Twitter at AKyleW and on Instagram at AKyleFandom.
That's right. And you can catch me, Adam, at OBPopCulture on both Twitter and Instagram. If you want to check out the site itself, Fandom Podcast Network, you can catch it at fpnet.podbean.com or you can catch it on Twitter at FanPodNetwork. And, of course, check it out on Instagram and Facebook as well. So before we get into it, I want to catch up with the guys and see how they've been doing. So, first of all, Kevin, let us know what you've been up to in the last month of podcasting, fandom, and more.
Oh, geez, gosh. Kyle and I have been pretty busy doing lots of stuff, of course, here on the Fandom Podcast Network. Of course, still doing Blood of Kings. Got Culture Clash going weekly. And about every monthly, I've got the hair metal podcast talking about all 1980s hair metal scene, and you know, just been real busy during the holidays here, so looking forward to talking about some action movies.
That's fantastic. And Kyle, what have you been up to lately? Let us know about the shows you've been doing and what you've been doing in fandom.
Oh, well, let's see here. Obviously, I'm very busy here at the Fandom Podcast Network. We got Culture Clash. We got The End Zone. I'm busy with Type 40 along with our good buddy Dan Hadley talking about the current season of Doctor Who. You know, we always got things in the works, Time Warps coming around the corner, Couch Potato Theaters. So that's been keeping me busy. On the flip side, I've been trying to get kind of caught up on my current season of television, especially the DC shows. I got to say Arrow season 7 has been a great rebound for that show. I'm really enjoying The Flash as well. A few things coming up though in December I want to check out, most notably season 2 of The Runaways on Hulu.
Very nice, very nice. Now, folks, we're going to head into a new segment straight away pretty much here today because we're going to be looking at a couple of movies which I think you should check out and what is really special about those. Of course, here in the new segment, we always look at what's current, what's coming up, but also
what you can find in your neck of the woods when it comes to B-grade film. So we're going to start with Kevin. You've got a movie to talk about here today on the news segment.
Yes, you know how when you look up a certain movie on IMDb, and then you start looking at who was in that film, and then you kind of click on their name, and then it takes you into another movie. You kind of go into this IMDb black hole, you know? It can happen with Google. It can happen with YouTube. We all know it. We've all been there. Well, Aaron and I were looking at this film that we were curious about that starred Keanu Reeves and Kiefer Sutherland and Lori Loughlin called Brotherhood of Justice. And this was a TV movie about these high school kids that decide to take on the local hooligans of their school and to try and correct some wrongs, hence calling themselves a Brotherhood of Justice. And we were looking at some of the other people in this movie, and Aaron's like, wait, I've seen this guy in something. And so we kind of click on his IMDb, and what she was talking about was this actor named Don Michael Paul. And I was looking at his IMDb, I'm like, wait, what's this movie that he did in 1987 called Rolling Vengeance? A truck driver builds a special 8-ton truck to help get revenge against the rednecks who killed his family. And so on. And so I'm like, well, I got to see this, right? And it actually had a Highlander television TV series link too, because Lisa Howard, who played Dr. Ann Lindsay on the TV series for a while, was on that show. And it's pretty much what it was billed to be. And this was when monster trucks were kind of becoming a thing in the United States. Bigfoot probably being the most celebrated one that everyone was excited about. So people were going to monster truck shows. And this movie did not disappoint. Very nice monster truck that was done in this. But Kyle, I was looking at Don Michael Paul's credits. He has a very distinctive credit as the writer for Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man.
Very interesting. And of course, that is one of the all-time classics of B-movie and cult cinema.
Yes, that was a 1991 classic. But this Don Michael Paul's been doing stuff behind the camera. He's still staying within the B-movie era, you could say. He recently was director for Death Race 4, the Scorpion, recent Scorpion Book of Souls. He did a Tremors movie. He's been also doing a lot of episodic television as well. But I do highly recommend Rolling Vengeance. You can actually watch it on YouTube for free. If you wish to purchase it, is also available on Amazon, I think, for like under $15. And you get to see Ned Beatty play the lead villain of these rednecks. And it's a film entirely in Canada, in the Toronto area, which was kind of interesting. So highly recommend Rolling Vengeance.
Wow, that's amazing. And again, it feels like it's got a Mad Max touch. We've got rolling war rigs and all that sort of stuff. Sounds good.
Okay, I have a quick question for you guys. Now, you guys were getting on me before we started the show because I didn't have a movie this week. But I did watch an old movie on El Rey, the El Rey channel, which is, for you international listeners, it's a channel that was created by Robert Rodriguez. So, now, this is an old school movie, but I don't know if it qualifies as B-movie or not, so I need a little help with this. Maximum Overdrive.
I think that falls under B-movie, I think.
Maximum Overdrive. Now, that's
great soundtrack, by the way. It was one of the first soundtracks I actually bought on CD.
Yeah.
Was that Mark Dacascos?
No, that was Emilio Estevez. It's when Halley's Comet passes by the Earth and all machines start coming to life.
Based on a Stephen King story.
Ah, okay, cool. Cool.
And I remember because it was AC/DC was on that soundtrack, and I think it falls under that category of the soundtrack kind of outlived the movie.
Yeah. However, I had forgotten, but Lisa Simpson herself, Nancy Cartwright, was in this film.
Oh, wow. We're going to have to check that out now. So Maximum Overdrive. There you go. So you got those two.
Wait, don't you mean Yeardley Smith. Yeardley Smith did Lisa Simpson. It was Nancy Cartwright who does.
Yeah, Yeardley Smith. You're right. Correct.
Yeah. Because Yeardley Smith has done a lot of acting.
Well, and so, she did. Wasn't she not on Herman's Head too, Kevin?
Yes, she was on Herman's Head. Good call there. Yep.
And folks, we also have a movie here for you to check out. If you're a fan of The Wise Guy, Ken Wahl. Now, Ken Wahl, of course, in the early 90s, went into obscurity pretty much, left celebrity life, decided not to be an actor anymore after an accident, and basically hasn't been in the public circle since. But he was an up-and-coming, amazing actor at the time, doing action films, and The Taking of Beverly Hills is one of those. But I've got one for you to check out here today, especially if you're a Mad Max nut like myself, you're going to love this movie. It is called The Gladiator. And no, not to be confused with, of course, Russell Crowe. This is a film which is all about road rage. So the brief synopsis here is, terror stalks the freeway of LA. A maniac known as the Skull is attacking innocent motorists with a terrifying car, custom built to destroy. One man vows to end the madman's reign of terror, determined to avenge his brother's death at the hands of the killer, master mechanic Rick, converts his pickup into a fighting machine, the Gladiator, a super truck, armed, dangerous, and ready for anything. Now, it also stars Nancy Allen from Robocop and, of course, Robert Culp from The Greatest American Hero. Now, the movie has basically a TV movie budget by the look of it, but the film itself is fantastic. 94 minutes of, I think, a great message. People shouldn't be drinking and driving. And this is what this is all about. This guy goes out to take out drunk drivers.
Mad.
I don't know how I missed this this epic movie. I want to see it now.
So go and check that out as well. Obviously,
Kyle, did you ever see this?
I have never even heard of this until now. So, I do notice that all three of the movies we just talked about are all related to vehicles and something.
Dude, it's got Rick Dees in it, man. Famous DJ. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Kyle.
I was going to say, this is Rick Dees with the Weekly Top 40.
So it's funny that The Gladiator is also known for the boxing movie with Brian Dennehy as well.
Yeah, we try to forget about that. if you're gonna give me a good, fun boxing movie, give me Digstown with Louis Gossett Jr. and what's his name? I'm blanking on his name now.
But Richard Gere.
No. I'm James Woods. Jimmy Woods.
I haven't seen that. What's that about?
James Woods is a con man. He's just getting out of jail, and he used to run this con with Lou Gossett Jr., who was this boxer. And he goes to this town, Digstown, where it's famous for it's kind of its amateur boxing. And he goes there to set up a con. And let's just say it kind of goes off the rails, and the interesting things happen. It's actually a great film. A lot of fun.
Wow, you have to check it out. Definitely. Now, folks, one of the biggest boxing movies has just landed in Australia. It's about to go out into the cinemas. I think it's today, actually. And that is, of course, Creed 2, which gets both Rocky Balboa and Drago back together. And they're basically the next generation of boxers as well. It's getting rave reviews here in Australia. But, guys, are you interested in seeing this film?
I've already seen it, actually, and it's getting good reviews over here as well. It's definitely a worthy successor in the Rocky movie / Creed franchise. I do recommend it.
Kind of a big piece of news out of that actually came today, where Sylvester Stallone said that will be his last movie playing Rocky Balboa.
He said probably.
If they put up the cash, I'm sure you'll come up, mate. You know, like he always said that last Rambo was the last Rambo. And guess what? Rambo's back as John Wayne now.
Kevin, there's your opening right there.
There we go.
Yeah, wait, no, I'm serious. The Raider nerd has already been on me about this. I want you to address with our Australian friend your take on Rambo 5 and what we had talked about.
Yeah, I thought you guys were a little harsh on Mr. Rambo there, because he was dressed as a cowboy, which apparently where he's from and what he used to do before he went into the military. You guys were getting a little judgy on one picture, so I'm going to call you out on that. Wait till you see the freaking movie, all right? You all liked Rambo 4. Don't lie about it, because it was good.
Now, but did you want it to go the way that we all thought it might have? And apparently there was a script about it, too, where he goes home. And obviously we see the end of Rambo. He's walking up that basically road to his house.
Yeah, on a ranch where there's people dressed up as cowboys, yes.
Apparently, yeah. But it was all about that ranch being taken over by a cartel or something like that, and it was more of a family.
Well, I heard that it wasn't necessarily the ranch being taken over, but that there was you know, the biggest threat nowadays are Mexican cartels, and so therefore that was going to be written into the script. So, as far as I know, that's still not out of the picture. So,
shall be interesting to see how we go, and how close this is to whether it's going to be. I have a feeling this is going to be more like a Shane sort of situation. The character's always been almost a lone gunslinger type, if you like. You know, it calls back to that tradition, particularly in the last couple of films. Not so much in First Blood, but First Blood is constructed like a Western.
Yeah to a certain degree, I see that, yeah.
Yeah, if you think about it, he walks into town and walks out of town, but it's his hero's journey that he has, which most gunslingers have. They come in, they basically resolve a conflict and then move on. And that's very much like Pale Rider. Pale Rider's a perfect example.
Yeah, but he doesn't he doesn't leave free, though.
Yeah, true.
It doesn't actually end well for Rambo at the end of the First Blood.
He's sent to a place where he has to turn big rocks into little rocks.
All right, so folks, we're going to get into the main section of our podcast here today. We're going to be chatting about, of course, the one, the only Chuck Norris, and of course, Invasion USA. Now, before we get into the plot and talk about a lot of the production and stuff like that, I want to get your first thoughts, fellas, on this one. So we'll start with you, Kyle. What is your first thoughts when it comes to Invasion USA?
I think Invasion USA is probably topped one or two of Chuck Norris's films. I think it's the most fun film of the ones he's done. This is one that really made the rounds on cable quite a bit. I don't remember it too much necessarily on like a TBS or anything like that because it was so edited. But no, this was the epitome of a canon film at the time too. This was screamed everything that represented canon films, everything that Chuck Norris was doing at the time. And for me, the one thing that I will always remember about Invasion USA, there is a scene where one of the bad guys is in a hotel room, or it might have even been Chuck. It's been a little bit since I've seen this. And playing in the background on TV was Spider-Man and his amazing friends.
Nice.
And I just remember it standing out. I'm like, and at the time when I first saw it, I was kind of still more a kid. I'm like, no, keep it on. I want to watch Spider-Man.
What about you, Kevin?
It's funny. I remember the scene with the couple on the beach, and they have a little television going on, and there's a famous Phyllis Diller interview on the Johnny Carson show, because I feel like I saw that live one night. It was funny. I remember this making the heavily edited rounds on television. It seemed, at least in my area, it was popping up every now and then. And I did not see it when it came out in the theater because I think it just kind of – I don't think it stayed very long, even though it did make some money. But it was one of those VHS rentals that I remember getting and eventually buying or recording or whatever and watching it over and over and over again. And my dad was a big Chuck Norris fan, so we were always watching these. I may have seen the heavily edited version first, maybe, but it definitely left an impact on me because this was during the time of Cold War and all this kind of stuff. And the thought of another country invading the U.S., specifically when you compare it to other films like Red Dawn, this to me was a little more realistic to a certain degree because it was a smaller terrorist faction, which is kind of what we're kind of seeing a little bit of nowadays. This was something that was really, really scary to me because the scenes in this film made an impact because of the terrorism that these guys were pulling off, whether it was, the mall scene or going into the residential area. When you saw the unedited version of this, it was very violent. Obviously we see the beginning of the film where the terrorists have taken over the Coast Guard boat and they kill all those refugees. But it's kind of subtle afterwards when the feds find the boat and they see all the killed crew members that are all laying on top of each other inside there, you know. So it was one of those things that was quite scary because you feel like, you know, if someone really wanted to do some damage, this is a way that they could do it.
Definitely. Now, folks, I'm going to basically give you a paragraph's worth of what this film's about, because really, at the end of the day, it is Chuck Norris kicking the butt of Cuban guerrillas. That's it. That's the plot. But the main plot of it is that we have a bunch of Cuban guerrillas run by a Soviet operative by the name of Mikhail Rostov, played by the character actor Richard Lynch, and a fake ghost Coast Guard captain who basically lets them in. And it's up to the former CIA agent, Matt Hunter, who's asked to come out of retirement, but he declines, but eventually relents, and his natural anti-hero, Chuck Norris, has to come to the aid of the American people to stop the invasion of the USA. So the film itself is, of course, made by Canon Pictures. And with Canon Films, I feel like they had obviously a track record of Norris before this, but this is really where they went to town. They said, look, let's give the director, Joseph Zito, the budget we can to get this guy out there. And Menahem Golan and Yoram Glovis, the producers and owners of the channel itself, Canon, really got behind it and gave them everything they really needed to make this probably one of the best stunt pictures as well ever made. So we're going to get into talking about the cast here, because I think this is one of the most interesting parts, is all about the cast itself. So, fellas, let's chat about Matt Hunter, the hero of this film, Chuck Norris.
It's Chuck Norris. Uh-huh. You can't go wrong. Yeah, you can't. This is probably Chuck Norris as he's just entering his prime, 80s prime. Yeah, and I think this was kind of the movie that, I mean, people knew Chuck Norris. They had seen some of his other films, but I think this is one of those movies that really put Chuck Norris up onto another level. And we talked about it a little before, and you brought up Canon Films. You know, I will say this about Canon Films, and especially these Chuck Norris films that he did around this time, when you're talking about Invasion USA, Missing in Action films, a few others, they really were, I think the Canon Films were one of the big key parts to the video rental revolution, because as so many people saw these films on video rentals, because they didn't have long lasting in the theater. But, you know, this is Chuck Norris at his finest. Full of action, carrying all the weapons, kicking butt, taking names, not leaving any prisoners behind, Kevin.
I would agree. Now, before I give my take on Matt Hunter here, I'm sorry, but isn't that also the same name as the hero from the Mask cartoon series?
No, that was Matt Tracker.
Tracker.
Oh, yeah. Matt Tracker. Okay.
You're getting Matt Tracker and Ace Hunter combined into one, because, you know, you...
I guess. They're both yeah. Badass, though, so yeah. I love them dearly. Okay, so... If you're going to talk about Matt Hunter here, okay, first of all, a couple of things I want to mention. When you watch the beginning of this film, I don't know if you've noticed, but there's a scene where he's wrangling the alligator with his friend. That's really Chuck Norris wrangling an alligator with his friend.
Yeah.
He's wrangling an alligator. I'm sorry. Are you going to be mad enough to go wrangle an alligator?
No.
I'm sorry. No. So there. I don't know if a lot of people really noticed that. He is wrangling an alligator. Okay, this is Chuck Norris.
Well, Canon Films wouldn't have had the budget to have a fake one.
Well, I mean, come on. I mean, I'm sure he got some tutelage from someone that knows what they're doing, but he did his own stunt with that thing. I'm sorry, but stuntman, do that for me now. So that was impressive, but you know, what I like about him, he's your typical kind of, you know, he doesn't have to say a lot of words. He's also he's more like gun action as opposed to karate action in this film, which I don't have a problem with because he's very good at it. And his iconic little twin mini Uzis that he has on the custom little like leather holsters on the side. Got to say, one of the coolest like action hero accessories of all time. Although I would have gone with 30 round clips instead of 20 round, but I thought that was pretty cool. But the one thing that I liked about this movie with the character of Matt Hunter is that he gets in the head of the bad guy played by Richard Lynch, Rostov, it's Rostov that keeps having these nightmares of when Chuck Norris confronted him once, stopping him from a terrorist attack. And he gets in his head, and he's able to ensnare him and his cronies at the end of the film. And I like how he's able to do that and to pull him out of hiding and to help threaten this whole terrorist operation. Even his Rostov's minions are saying, you know, you don't, let's not worry about him, you know, but Rostov is too, you know, caught up in getting revenge and trying to kill Matt Hunter. And that's one of the things that I like about this film.
Definitely. Now, you've talked about, of course, one of the greatest character actors, I think, of the 1980s, not just as villains. He's played about just about everything when it comes to that. And, of course, we're talking about Richard Lynch. Now, here's just a few of the credits, and I'm sure all of you know these movies. The Sword and the Sorcerer, The Seven Ups, Scarecrow, Little Nikita, Bad Dreams, Halloween. In science fiction circles, he's known for Wolf in Battlestar Galactica. In Galactica 1980, if you really have watched that, Commander Xavier he played. He was also in T.J. Hooker, Blue Thunder, Airwolf, The A-Team, Charmed, and Star Trek The Next Generation.
We got to talk about Star Trek Next Generation because he played the character of Baran. It was a great two-parter where Picard goes undercover as a antiquities kind of, like, you know, anti-Indiana Jones guy, you know, or maybe he's doing the Indiana Jones type, but these guys are trying to find this Vulcan Stone of Gaul or whatever it is, and he was really good in that. But for Highlander fans, he was in a really cool episode called Blind Faith, where normally when you watch a Highlander TV series, you have your immortal bad guy of the week, and Duncan has to kill and fight him. Well, this time, there's a little twist on his character, and he was really good at it, where he was a bad guy, but then he tries to repent, and he takes up nonviolent ways and tries to he's trying to change his ways, and Duncan doesn't believe him. And it was a really good episode on, like, you know, Duncan's beliefs and, you know, what can someone who's done bad actually now do good? So it was interesting to see Richard Lynch start to play a bad guy, but then turn around and play someone you actually are kind of rooting for.
Interesting. What about you, Kyle? You know much about Richard Lynch?
You know, just that every time I looked, he was on something on my TV in the 80s. That's for sure. I mean, you went down the credits. I mean, Sword and Sorcerer is one of my all-time cult classic fun movies. One of the greatest movie weapons, if not the most insanely designed movie weapon of all time, except maybe for Nick Cage's new axe. And what is it, Nancy, Kevin? Is the name of that film?
Which one? Oh, Nicolas Cage's Mandy. Yes. One of the best on-screen bladed weapons of all time.
But that's the thing about the 80s, and especially these kind of films, they were filled with so many character actors where you were like, okay, maybe you don't know that guy's name, but the minute you see him on screen, you know who he is. Oh, he was this guy in that, or this guy in this. And that, you know, that's just one of the things that makes these kind of movies so great, is these great character actors.
You have to really give credit to his 90s IMDb. He did a lot more work in the 90s. A lot of you know, B movies and a lot of television appearances. The Star Trek episode I'm talking about, by the way, is Gambit Part 1 and 2. But what's interesting about him was that before he became an actor, he actually joined the United States Marine Corps in 1958, and he served 4 years where he made corporal. And he did a tour of the Middle East with the 6th Fleet. So kudos to him and his services.
Very cool.
Without a doubt. And I think also he was somebody who was slightly disfigured, had like a burn scars across his face. Now, this was due to a mishap that happened before he started his acting career, where he basically got burnt a lot of, I think 70% of his body got burnt by flames. But when he turned that around, he basically realized that, look, I don't want to be involved in mucking around, whether it's with alcohol or drugs or whatever, and took up acting. Basically, it was his out.
Yeah, he went on to do a lot of stuff, and he's always played the heavy. He's always played the bad guy. I remember him... And is it 88 film? I think it was called, Bad Dreams, I think it was, where he was like part of a cult leader, and he was really good in that. He's always played the good guy. And so, you know, and I think that he's more known for that. And I think it was something he excelled at.
He's also, a lot of people might remember him from Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, where he was on the casino planet.
Ah, that's right. Yeah, I remember that.
So very interesting actor. Now, next one I'm going to be talking about is Melissa Prophet. Now, Melissa Prophet's one I don't know a lot about, to be honest. Dahlia McGuire is who she plays in the movie. But she was in Casino, Goodfellas. She was in Action Jackson and a whole heap of others through the 1980s and onto the 90s. Now, do you guys know much about Melissa Prophet?
I don't really remember much, except she was the reporter in this movie, right?
Yes.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really only remember her in this film. I don't remember her role in Casino or Goodfellas or Action Jackson. The role that sits with me is Invasion USA because of the character that she played.
Yeah, I'd echo Kevin. Kevin
the newscaster in Action Jackson too.
Yeah, I'm with Kevin. My sentiments are exactly the same. I just don't remember her much. So, I mean, I remember Action Jackson, but I don't remember her role in that per se.
The character I recognized most out of this too, and he didn't have a large role in it, was Billy Drago.
Oh, yeah.
He played the drug deal that went wrong in the beginning of the film after with the cocaine for the guns type of thing. Of course, we've seen him in Delta Force 2, and he was Frank Nitti in The Untouchables and such. So yeah, he's done a lot of really good bad guys as well, but. You know, some of these other characters, like Alexander Zale is Nico. I have seen him and stuff. He was the one that killed a couple on the beach. But yeah, the Billy Drago was probably the person I recognized the most after Lynch and Norris.
I have to agree, too. Now, moving on, we're going to be moving into the actual production of the film itself. Now, where did this whole idea come from? Well, the film was part of a 6-film contract deal that Chuck Norris had signed with Canon Films. And, of course, this is due to the success of the Missing in Action franchise. Now, of course, that franchise has got an interesting past itself, and you can catch that on future episodes of this show. We'll be chatting about those as well. But Norris had the idea making the film after he'd read a Reader's Digest that said hundreds of terrorists were running loose in the United States. And he thought, well, boy, that's crazy. So the whole idea was basically stemmed from there. What would happen if that happened in the United States? So... in some ways, he was trying to make, an idea of what would happen at that stage in the 1980s, in the middle of the Cold War. So do you think this is, I personally see it from what I've seen of the movies, TV shows at the time. That was a big thing that was going on in the mid-80s for film.
Yeah, one of the scariest subplots of this film, it's something that I thought was very smart in the script to... spread panic and fear among the civilians is having cops turn on civilians and kill civilians. And there's a scene in there where you get those two cops coming up on a neighborhood and shooting up these guys having a party outside. And then one of the terrorists says, "Leave witnesses." And so that right there, if you turn the people against any authority, it helps the terrorist creating confusion and chaos, because now the people are turning on their own.
Yeah. What about you, Cole? You reckon this was a prevalent theme in the 1980s?
Oh, yeah. Anything involving U.S. versus Russia was a huge thing in the 1980s. I mean, you name the war espionage kind of movie, it was always something about that. But in this one, Kevin has a good point. This one was written very intelligently to play upon paranoia in the U.S. at the time. I would say about the time this came out, Kevin, that was maybe just about the height of the tension in the Cold War, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, definitely. What's interesting, too, about this is it was also the height of a lot of the gangs and the drugs going on in Florida and the cartels bringing stuff in there. So it's interesting how that was kind of tied in a little bit with that, with the drug deal that was going on in the beginning of this movie. But yeah, this was definitely the height of the Cold War and spies but it's interesting because a lot of those films were talking about the Cold War, where this is where we're getting, terrorist coming in on our soil, which hit home for us many years later.
Yeah, very much so.
It's crazy, isn't it? So the film itself had a budget of $12 million, and it's twice what basically any of the Chuck Norris pictures or action pictures in general, particularly with Canon, had normally gotten. So we're talking about something that was pretty much considered an A-grade film. It's an A-grade, B-grade, if you like. To look at just some of the money that was spent, $2 million was spent in the Everglades area and that alone with the action scenes, and Norris took $2 million paycheck on this movie. Now, you think about it, for 1985, that's massive for any action stuff.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, that's massive now. I mean, but then, yeah, that was, especially for Canon, which did not have exactly a ton of money in the bank, shall we say.
Without a doubt. Now, I hope all you listeners have checked out the documentary Electric Boogaloo, The Wild Untold Story of Canon Films. Now, this actually shows you where they came from, where Canon Films began, but it also shows and charts a lot of what Norris was going through as one of the contract players. Now, one of the interesting things is they talk about in that documentary, basically the International Airport area where Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International was basically going to take out in a whole suburban area just so they could build this new development. So around there and part of the Avondale Mall, they had free right to explode, destroy, and basically go all through carnage there to do what they wanted to do in this movie with stunts using that suburban area. And, of course, we see that in the film, don't we, fellas?
Yeah, one of the interesting and scary things was when Richard Lynch's character takes the rocket launcher and starts blowing up houses indiscriminately. And I always was curious about that scene. I'm like, man, where did they go to film that? And then I learned years later that where I reside here in the Atlanta area is where they filmed a lot of this movie. And apparently that area, that residential area, was set up for demolition because they were expanding the Atlanta airport. And the area now is currently known as the site of the Georgia International Convention Center in College Park, Georgia, which is right next to the airport there. And you drive through that all the time when you go to the airport. So it's funny that I've actually driven through the area where that scene took place.
And what about you, Kyle? Have you been to the site of that area yourself?
I've been to the airport. I haven't exactly been through that area, but, you know, Georgia, especially Atlanta, is apparently the new Hollywood these days. So apparently that started a lot sooner than any of us thought it did.
Now, Norris also said a sequence that there cost over $5 million. Now, his quote is that there are tanks firing and helicopters flying all among these real buildings, he said. And it's a battle like in Gone with the Wind, one of the best action battle sequences that's ever been done so far. And if you think about it, for 85 and for the budget that they had for this theatrical film, he's right.
You look at that end battle scene where they trap Richard Lynch's and his terrorist in the building, and you see all the tank extras, you know, that they use and the helicopters. It's actually quite impressive for the amount. There's a couple of really good scenes where you see, like, it seems like five or six tanks rolling up and surrounding this building, you know?
Yeah.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, the budget for this movie, again, for the type of movie it was and the time for it, was a huge budget. And I mean, they spent every penny they got, and they probably spent a little more than just the initial $12 million.
It's crazy, isn't it? Now, the film itself had quite a mixed reception when it came out. Roger Ebert himself wrote in the Chicago Sun-Times that it was a stereotypical clone of action movies. However, like a lot of the other Canon films, it has a massive cult following. And as we're talking about today, it's evidence that this film has quite a following. I mean, I'm somebody that if it's on TV, I'm not going to change the channel. I'm going to watch the whole film.
Yeah, you know, I disagreed a lot with what Roger Ebert said back in those days. you know, if you don't like this film, then you just don't like film. I mean, this had everything that you wanted at the time, and it gave you a great action hero, great bad guy, and a scary situation that you could see yourself in with the current times and what was happening in the news and such. And I mean, there's a lot of great action scenes in here. And I have it playing on in the background where, you know, the reporter is taken hostage by the one of the terrorists, and and Chuck Norris kind of just grabs his gun and points it at his head, and he ends up shooting himself in the head. Yeah. And he just does it so slyly, you know, as he came in. Just little things like that just make him so cool.
Yeah, I mean, but that was a trademark of Canon Films too, was, you know, the action in all those Chuck Norris movies was intentionally a little over the top, but it's what makes those movies so great now, what makes them stand out now. Because, you know, the great thing about Invasion USA and all of the Norris films that were done by Canon was you knew what you were getting, and how you cannot enjoy that, especially in that day and age, and even now, because there's something about those films that just appeals to, especially the inner guy who likes movies. You know, that's what it boils down to. And I mean, come on, you've got the good guy and bad guy, and it's clear cut. There's no question, and it's Chuck Norris being Chuck Norris.
Yeah, and what really I think elevates this movie is Richard Lynch as Rostov, because he is just so good at being bad in this film. And I don't know if you guys noticed this, but twice in the film, Richard Lynch shoots somebody in the crotch. I don't know if you remember this or not.
He does.
In the beginning of the film where he does the drug exchange with Billy Drago's character, Drago has the gun in his waistband, and he ends up like pushing him up against the wall and then taking the gun and shooting it into the guy's crotch. And then later on, with one of his cronies, he gets mad at him after the guy says, after the guy relays the message that, Matt says that how he's going to die, he gets mad and he shoots him in the crotch.
There are a lot of Sopranos at the end of this film.
Yes, yes. What I found interesting, though, was that Avenging Force, which came out a year later, starring Michael Dudikoff, was originally written as a sequel to this film. And when Chuck wasn't interested, they decided to give it to rising Canon star Michael Dudikoff instead. Of course, also stars Steve James.
Of course.
From, you know, the duo that we also know from American Ninja.
Interesting thing, if you go back in history, how linked Michael Dudikoff and Chuck Norris actually are. There's a lot of Project Dudikoff got that Chuck Norris decided he didn't want to go. And if you remember, Dudikoff was to be Chuck Norris's replacement at Canon Films when Norris decided that Canon couldn't pay him enough money anymore and things like that. They were grooming Michael Dudikoff to be Chuck Norris's replacement as kind of the new younger action hero. And then it didn't go well for Canon.
It's crazy. Yeah, this movie does have some interesting trivia, and some of the stuff I found just today alone will surprise some of you. Now, of course, we have Richard Lynch playing Rostov, but originally it was meant to be Steven Berkoff.
Interesting.
The bad guy from Beverly Hills Cop, and apparently he turned it down because of the violence.
Yeah, crazy, eh?
I'm sorry, I would never turn down a role because of the violence.
Now, what's interesting, too, is Whoopi Goldberg was Chuck Norris's first choice to play the female journalist, but Joseph Zito disagreed and cast someone else instead.
Interesting.
Would that have been weird. Yeah. What do you think, Kyle?
Yeah, this is not a Whoopi Goldberg film.
Now, the movie that Hunter is watching when he's arrested is called Earth versus the Flying Saucers from 1956, classic sci-fi.
That's one of the classics. Yeah. I do remember that. Did you guys notice the body count in this film? It's pretty high. It's 129.
Now, I want to bring up an interesting point, because we talk about how violent this movie is and you talk about the body count. Yet, Chuck Norris was the reason why Expendables 2 was rated PG-13 instead of R.
Wow.
He wouldn't come. He wanted it to where everybody could go see it if he was going to be in it.
Now, when the German version was done, the main antagonist's name was Haynes. His backstory was edited to make him an American terrorist. Germany is split into East and West at the time, and the U.S. had a tense relationship with the USSR, so that's why it was changed.
Interesting.
Mm. So that's pretty crazy. The original title was simply Invasion.
It's scarier if it says Invasion USA.
Come on. We're waiting for that sequel, though, Invasion Australia.
Yeah. I wonder if the title of this was changed with overseas. Was it always called Invasion USA over there in Australia?
Always had Invasion USA out here. It's one of the few that didn't get changed.
I guess it would make more of an impact overseas if there was an actual film of the USA being invaded because it's a superpower nation, you know. So
certainly is. Now, one of the other ones too that's interesting, Chuck Norris, obviously we know, performed a lot of his stunts, but the scene where he hangs off the side of the pickup while it's driven through the shopping center and kiosks and windows, that's actually him.
Doesn't surprise me because he did wrestle an alligator.
Of course, you know, if this movie had a $10 million budget, it wouldn't be a real alligator. But Chuck stepped up to the plate. Stepped up.
Yeah, he did.
Now, getting away from that sort of thing right now, this film, obviously cult, so it's going to be something that was huge in 1985. When it was released, I think in Australia, in VHS and Betamax, out here on VHS, it was a huge cult hit. Like, it was, you could never get it on the shelves. It was always out. It was always rented. So I want to hear from you guys. Kyle, start with you. Where did you see it on VHS, or did you see it on TV first when it was off the theatrical run?
I remember seeing it on VHS. That's where I saw a lot of my 80s films, especially when I was younger. Didn't have great TV where I was living at the time, but videos, when the video stores opened, the biggest problem was, like, any of these kind of movies, they were hard. It was like, if you saw it on the shelf, you grabbed it and rented it because you didn't. Otherwise, who knows? But again, I go back to what I brought up a little bit earlier. Canon Films were the kings of VHS rental. Without a doubt, they were that B-movie VHS rental kings. And I mean, again, I remember anytime a new Chuck Norris movie came out on to the new releases, good luck trying to get it anytime out of the gate fast.
And Kev, what about yourself? Where did you see this?
Yeah, I mentioned earlier it was probably an edited version on TV that I saw, and then I saw it on VHS. I think I remember recording it off TV first, maybe, and rewatching it. And then I remember seeing the unedited version on VHS, and thought it was pretty darn cool. But yeah, that's what I remember, because I never did see this when it first came in the theater, because I don't think it lasted very long in the theater.
No, definitely not. One of the interesting things is between those, we obviously got the TV run of the film, you have VHS and theatrical. Now, one of the things in the 80s out here in Australia in particular, we had a number of different classification systems. What was stupid about Australia, you can ask Aaron this, you'll know what I mean, is that we had two different classes of classifications, one for TV, one for film, so one in the theatrical and VHS market, that sort of thing. And what was stupid about the TV ones, they ended up having a hell of a lot more blood than there used to be in the main prints. But they would drop all the F-bombs. They would drop all the S-words, this and that. And it's weird because one would leave out one thing, one would leave out the other. So instead of having an M15 plus for mature, say that would be PG-13, for example, out here, what they would change it to was adults only. And then that was the TV version. Or it'd be AOM, adults only, mature, which is like an R rating. So you wouldn't be able to see those things unless it was at 9 p.m. at night. But Chuck tended to get a lot of those heavily edited cuts out here. So the F-bomb turned out to be frickin', things like that. Did you guys have a different classification system for TV?
Yeah, I mean, we have like mature and, you know, whatever it is, PG, family and stuff like that. But, I when it comes to the TV versions, they would just basically edit out all the heavy violence and language, you know, and then they would have somebody kind of like overdub maybe one of the bad languages and say something else. And sometimes it was very obvious and, you know, sometimes it was subtle. just so it could play at any time during the day. But then, you know, you would see Invasion USA. I think Kyle, you would also see it like on HBO or Cinemax or something too, right? These were the pay channels, so you would not see the edited version.
Yeah, they were constantly running on HBO and Cinemax and Showtime, especially HBO and Cinemax. They were very popular for playing the Chuck Norris movies on.
Interesting. We've got another one out here which is on the cable lines with Showtime channel on Foxtel out here, which is our big cable channel. And they tend to have a lot of those 1990s Chuck ones into the early 2000s. I mean, they even have Hero and the Terror. I remember the Hitman one he did. I think it was just called Hitman. I can't remember.
But talk about a mullet.
The mullet. Yeah, the mullet was the one. They should have just called it Mullet Man. But, you know, it was a great thing to catch up with those ones that you may have missed. They even ran Sidekicks for a while in there, which was a great little TV show at the time. They used to have a double on those channels of Sidekicks and The Master.
Now that's a karate double right there.
Oh, yeah. Lee Van Cleef. You can't go better than that. I mean, he was even in the Octagon with Norris.
Oh, yeah.
The master of B-films right there, Lee Van Cleef.
Lee Van Cleef. It's crazy, isn't it? So when I get your thoughts, guys, now looking back on this film, your final thoughts on why this film is such a classic cult film. So, Kev, your thoughts.
Oh, man. First of all, I think it's paced really well. It's like an hour and 50 minutes, I think. But there's tension throughout the whole film. And there's so many good action scenes in it. And I think, to be honest with you, the character development is also good. The actress, I'm forgetting her name, that plays the reporter, I don't think she is really, you know, a great actress, but she's entertaining because of the relationship that she has with Matt, and you know how it starts off and how she's always like showing up on the scene of these terrorist actions and stuff. But and it's not just, you know, him going up against terrorists and stuff. You also got this one-on-one thing with him and Rostov, and Richard Lynch basically being tormented by Matt's character. And you know, it's a cult classic. You when it's on, you watch it. It's a perfect couch potato theater movie as well. And it's the backdrop is terrifying. It really is. And it's something at the time that it really scared you, like what could happen in real life if terrorists got organized and were on our soil. And that scared me.
Yeah. No, you hit it right on the head there, Kevin. I mean, I think this falls under cult classic for so many great reasons. You hit on a lot of them: the pacing, the intelligence of the writing, and the aspect of this was a more than Red Dawn. This is probably, if there was going to be an invasion, this is probably how it was going to go. Red Dawn was probably a little over the top in how an invasion went, but what it is too is, I mean, it is Chuck Norris. This is one of those films that when you think Chuck Norris, is one of the first things that comes to mind, you know, and Chuck Norris is an action icon of the 80s. And he's one of the all time classics. And the thing with this particular film is, and Kevin brought up this point earlier in the episode, this was a little bit different action, even for Chuck Norris. There wasn't that big Kevy karate influence in this film. This was him basically pulling out the guns, taking down the bad guys, doing what it takes to get the job done. And again, you add in all the elements that we know, look back on now, and what make a cult film, and you add in the Chuck Norris, you add in the action in this film, you add in all the great character actors in this film, and you add in that canon film stamp, and that's what makes this classic 80s B-movie without a doubt.
I mean, wouldn't you say when you watched a film and you saw that Canon logo come across the beginning of the film, there's a little bit extra excitement?
You're in for a wild ride. When you see that, hear that music play, and you see that silver sea come up, and you're just like, oh yeah, it's gonna be bloody.
It was the Burger King of 80s action films. I mean, you knew what you were getting. You know, what I mean is it's a franchise or in this case, a production company that you knew what you were getting. You know, if you're going to a burger store like Burger King, for example, you know what you're getting. And I think that's the great thing about Chuck Norris working with Canon is no matter what you rented from the movie store, you could trust those guys to give you the action you deserve.
Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes not so much on the effects, but you got the action.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, this film had a lot of practical effects, which was also good, you know.
You know, real pyrotechnics, right up to, of course, the likes of when Canon did Masters of the Universe, which I think the ultimate pinnacle of what they... I mean, they ran out of budget on that one, just on effects alone. So you could see where this was leading. And I think this film itself, from my perspective, was a good prelude to what we got in Delta Force, you know? He was ready to go A-grade, don't you think?
Yeah, I think...
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah,
I think Delta Force was kind of like his real transition to A grade in that aspect.
Kev, your thoughts?
I would agree, definitely. I mean, you know, especially with the supporting cast he had in Delta Force, Chuck Norris's stardom was on the rise as an action hero. You know, he's the kind of silent, you know, few words type of hero that we like to see, where he was more of a man of action than words. But you know, he did have his good one-liners, you know. So
I think the strength of Norris with one-liners is that he plays it so straight. And I think that's why they work so well.
You know, it's like the scene you know, Invasion USA where he shoots the guys pretending to be National Guards guys, and there's the one Asian guy that, you know, is on the ground, and he goes up to him and says, "You have anything to say?" And he goes, "Rah rah rah rah." And he goes, "Didn't think so."
Okay. I have to ask you guys this, since we're talking Chuck Norris. What is the most improbable Chuck Norris scene of all time?
In this film?
In general, of everything he's done, what is the most improbable Chuck Norris film scene?
Oh, Firewalker. When he's in the desert.
Improbable. Gosh, I don't know. I mean, I remember seeing some Texas Walker... Texas Ranger. Yeah, where like you can obviously tell it's not him doing some of the action scenes when he decided to relent and give it up to a stunt guy. But what are you referring to, Kyle?
It's got
to
be when he drives his truck from being buried alive in Lone Wolf McQuade, and he's popping a beer as he's doing it.
In the beginning of that film, doesn't he take like his Remington scoped rifle and take out a bunch of bad guys too? A lever action rifle, man. That dude was on par with that gun.
It's absolute madness. Now, what's your favorite scene in this film, guys? Start with you, Cole. What is the lasting memory of this movie?
Oh, it's the scene where they're blowing up the neighborhood. I mean, that is so surreal to watch. And when you find out the history of that scene, it's even more crazy. But especially at the time you're just watching this and you're like, what? Am I actually seeing this? Because it's not something that had been really portrayed on the big screen in a long time. And as it happening in the U.S. And again, we have this big, I mean, where it was all practical effects. They blew up this neighborhood in Atlanta. And you're just like, did I just see that? I think that's one of the most memorable things of that film.
It's brilliant.
I think the shopping mall scene was pretty intense during Christmas time. And, you know, it starts off kind of innocently where you got the kid chewing the bubble gum and he throws the gum on the truck that's going to be featured shortly. And, you know, and then you see the guy planting the bomb but then you see Chuck Norris and his big truck come slamming through the front doors and taking on these bad guys. And then they're driving through all the kiosks and, you know, through that busy Christmas mall area. And that was a pretty intense scene there.
That'd probably be number two for me.
I put it up there with the scenes from the likes of the Blues Brothers in terms of just great car and, in this case, truck action. And we see a pickup doing that sort of stuff. It's just madness. It's fantastic. I think it's quintessential Chuck.
Yeah, the other scene too that I always remember when they try the terrorists try to blow up the church with the bomb, and they hit the button and it's not working, and he's up on the roof saying looking for this, and he throws it down there and he hot wires it and blows them up.
Now, before we leave you today, I'm going to let you know a little bit about the channel itself, where you can find the channel itself. Now, Kyle, tell us about your TeePublic. Tell us about where folks can find shirts and apparel for Fandom Podcast Network.
Absolutely. You can visit teepublic.com and search Fandom Podcast Network, and there you're going to find all the great gear of the Fandom Podcast Network, where you can get logos for Blood of Kings, Culture Clash, the Fandom Podcast Network itself, Discoville, and you can get it on all kinds of great things, whether it's t-shirts, mugs, iPhone cases, laptop cases, or in Kevin's case, his favorite, tapestries.
Now, Kevin, tell us about Fandom Podcast Network. Obviously, the master feed's at fpnet.podbean.com. But what shows can we find there, and how can the listeners get involved in checking them out?
Oh, man, we got a lot of great shows on the master feed at fpnet.podbean.com. Of course, we've got Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast. We've got Culture Clash, our weekly fandom news show that I co-host with Kyle. Couch Potato Theater, where we have all those great classic and cult films, which this film would definitely qualify for. Time Warp, the Fandom Podcast Network, where we celebrate our fandoms. And right now we're going to be finishing up 1985, the movies, which also included this film. We also have Time Warp, the NFL podcast that Kyle and I co-host. We have Good Evening, our Alfred Hitchcock podcast. We have Discoville, our Star Trek Discovery and Orville podcast. The one that I host is the Hair Metal podcast, talking about all of the hard rock bands, hair metal bands from the 1980s. And we also have Doctor Who, Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast. And, of course, this one we are listening to right now, The Lethal Mullet.
That's the one. So go and check those out. And, folks, if you enjoy the shows, please subscribe to the iTunes and Podbean app. And even leave a review for us too. We love 5-star reviews, of course, and we love feedback in general. It lets us know what you want to listen to on this channel. So without further ado, I want to thank Kyle and, of course, Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel for being on the show today. Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat about Chuck Norris. And what would you like to say to the listeners before we go, Kyle?
You know, just keep listening, and thank you for listening. You know, the holidays are, at the time of recording this, are right around the corner, and I just want to say thank you for another great year at the Fandom Podcast Network, and we are very happy to have a Lethal Mullet now part of the network.
Agreed. This show's a great addition to the network. As we're heading into the holidays, we hope you guys have a wonderful holiday and New Year, and make sure you keep listening for more Lethal Mullet. We'll be talking some more great 80s action movies.
That's right. A lot more Chuck Norris coming your way. I'm Adam O'Brien, coming live to you from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia. G'day, good afternoon, good evening, and good night, and we'll catch you next time on Fandom Podcast Network.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to recommend these other great podcasts on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture podcast with the latest news, reviews, and other fun topics in pop culture. Also, Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast where we discuss all things Highlander. Couch Potato Theater, our podcast celebrating the cult classic and fan favorite movies we don't get off the couch for. Time Warp, a look back on our classic and nostalgic fandoms that we still celebrate today. The End Zone, our podcast talking about all things current in the NFL and giving our best mediocre fantasy football advice. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. Discoville, a Star Trek Discovery and the Orville podcast. The Hair Metal podcast, if you're a hard rock music fan, the Hair Metal podcast rediscovers the nostalgia of the 1980s hair metal bands. And Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, as we discuss all things Doctor Who, past and present. You can find these great shows on the Fandom Podcast Master Feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play. On Facebook, you can find us at Fandom Podcast Network. On Instagram, we are at Fandom Podcast Network. And on Twitter, at FanPod Network. You can also email us directly at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and support the Fandom Podcast Network. And remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.